Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Commerce Committee for January 28th. Representative Lislegard, have you had a chance to take a look at the minutes? And if so, would you like to move their approval?
I have, Madam Chair, and I would make a motion.
Any discussion? With that, Representative Lislegard has moved approval of the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. And today, the roadmap for our day is that we are going to get to hear an overview of Minnesota's financial services and banking industries. So we're pleased to have our guests here. And then we will hear from Representative Stevens on his bill, House File 319. So with that, we are going to hear from the banking industry and would like to turn it over to our testifiers. Thank you. You can just introduce yourselves to the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association.
And I'm Teresa Kuvas with Minnesota Bankers Association. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to give a brief overview of the banking industry and of our association. So the MBA is the largest state banking trade group in the state of Minnesota, obviously. And our focus is on improving the banking environment. And we have about 95% of the banks in Minnesota as members of our association. So to kind of look at the state in general, we have 343 banks with a location in Minnesota. 297 of those banks are headquartered here, with about 50,000 bank employees around the state. To look at how we compare to the rest of the country, we are actually number three for the most banks in the United States, only behind Illinois and Texas. So we have 5.5% of the banks in Minnesota, just above Iowa, which is actually kind of surprising that Iowa is not that far behind us, and they are inching up on us as well. To kind of look at where bank consolidations have gone from the past 17 years. We started 2001 with around 500 banks in Minnesota, and we are down to, we're going to go back a slide. Totally skip over that. So the 297 banks chartered in Minnesota, we have 149 of those banks in the metro area. And the deposits, Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank make up a good chunk of the deposits in the state, making up 62%, and the rest of the banks in the state have 3.5% or less. The median size is $115 million with about 25 to 30 employees. And if you look at the smallest community bank in the state, it's probably around $8 to $10 million in assets. So here's some of the consolidation information. So we've gone from over about 500 to the 297 where we are today. I was actually reading an article that was written at the end of last year, and it talks about in the last 5 years, throughout the country, we've lost about 1,300 banks due to mergers and acquisitions. From the start of the financial crisis, we had about 8,500 banks, and at the end or at the middle of 2018, there was 5,600. And just in the last 5 years, it's about 12 to 1,300 that we have seen consolidate. And I'm sure you probably also saw yesterday the TCF announced that they will be merging with Chemical Bank in Detroit.
I'm going to talk a little bit about bank regulation just to give you an idea of how these banks are governed by the feds and the state officials. The banking industry is among the highest regulated industry in the United States. We have extensive on-site examinations, which means that a team of examiners probably work off-site first, but then they come on-site. And depending on the size of the bank, that exam can be a week to, I suppose, the largest banks have them on site constantly. They have an office and they live there. Banks also file call reports quarterly, so they're letting the government know how they're doing with all their loans and deposits and everything quarterly. So we have a dual banking system in this country, and our banks are either nationally or state chartered banks. So 22% are national banks and 78% are state chartered banks. I think those are Minnesota figures. So the majority of our banks have a state charter. The OCC is the regulator for nationally chartered banks. And then state chartered banks are examined by both the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and then either the FDIC or the Federal Reserve. Banks that are over $10 billion in assets are also examined by the CFPB. And then their bank holding companies, the business that holds the bank, is also examined by the Federal Reserve. So these on-site examinations happen at least every 18 months. That's going to be the longest span that they could go without an exam. And there are separate exams for safety and soundness, so just making sure that that bank is fiscally sound and not going to fail. And then there's a separate exam for compliance with consumer regulations. And then we have information technology exams, looking at their computer systems. And then we have also a bank holding company exam. So there are a lot of exams going on all the time. If you have a small bank, just to give you an idea of the cost, it's around $30,000 to $40,000 to pay for an exam. So national banks, they pay the OCC for their exams, and then at the state chartered banks will pay the Department of Commerce, the FDIC, and the Fed don't charge. We have some slides on elder financial abuse, just because this has been an issue of concern, I think, to everyone in Minnesota, but our bankers are seeing an uptick in the occurrences of elder fraud situations. And I'm sure that you know this, but they're saying 1 in 10 Americans that are 60 plus have experienced some form of elder abuse. And most of it involves family members, which makes it difficult for banks when they spot that kind of thing. It's a little bit harder to see. You know, you can't be sure if they're using the money to pay for something legitimate or not. Those are a little bit more difficult to spot. So the MBA has tried to help our bankers with training to make sure that they are able to spot senior fraud when it's occurring. So we, together with the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, AARP, and the Department of Human Services, put together a three-part video series, and that helps our bankers learn how to spot and how to deal with elder fraud situations. We also offer a program through the American Bankers Association that's free to all of our banks that provides bankers with training on tools and resources. It also helps them make presentations to their customers. So a lot of times banks put on seminars for their older customers to help them spot scams. But the fact is they're very difficult situations to handle. You can have a banker tell you something's a scam and the customer will still go ahead with it. You can involve the Secret Service, and the Secret Service can tell them it's a scam, and they'll still go ahead with it. You know, so it can be very, very difficult to stop sometimes, which is frustrating for all parties there. But so what the banks do when they spot a situation like that is they report to the MARC system. Used to be called the Common Entry Point. It's called MARC now. So there's a one number that a banker can call or anyone can call to report senior fraud, and then they're going to pass that on to the appropriate person to investigate. I think what we're hearing from our banks is that they're reporting a lot, but they're not hearing back a lot. So that's one of their frustrations, because they feel like they report, but nothing happens. We feel good about the reports that we're making. We're making a lot of reports, but there just aren't the resources, perhaps, to deal with all of these situations.
One of the things that we wanted to touch on a little bit was financial literacy. This has obviously been a topic that we always are part of. There's obviously financial literacy for all ages, from your younger kids through high school, as you're getting into college, and the Minnesota Bankers Association offers a lot of products and programs to our members. A lot of our members do have programs also in place within their banks. They do hold community meetings on financial literacy, but a lot of what our members do offer is they actually partner with a lot of nonprofits, because as you can imagine, people don't always necessarily come into their banks wanting to discuss their financial literacy concerns. So we do partner with a lot of nonprofits, and you'll actually hear about one being Prepare and Prosper. One of our banks, Sunrise Banks, has been working with them on a product for the FAIR initiative, which is to kind of help some of the unbanked and underbanked get more comfortable with their financial literacy and find products and work on their credit scores and everything to kind of get them more into the banking system. I know you're going to be hearing from Representative Stevenson shortly about his bill, but to kind of touch on some of the federal government shutdown. I can come up later on the bill, or I can just kind of talk a little bit now. a lot of our members were on the front lines when the shutdown happened, and they were reaching out to their customers either through websites or phone calls, and they had put programs in place. Some were with really low interest rates to kind of help them get through these times until they were able to get back into their job, obviously, to get paid. And then the bill that Representative Stevenson has, I've worked closely with him since probably mid last week when he started talking about the bill. And that one is a little bit different from what our banks offer. You know, most of the programs within our banks are for their customers, and the difference being that Representative Stevenson's bill does open it up to non-customers, and so that Sunrise is one of the banks that will be up speaking on the bill later, and they would be one of those ones that is interested in helping if the shutdown does happen again. So with that, our information is here. We are always a resource. We have, obviously, a lot of banks as members, and so if ever there is an issue, feel free to give us a call.
Thank you. Do members have any questions at this time? Yes, Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. I have a quick question about bank consolidation. You have the one chart. So I'm from Shakopee, and we've had a significant amount. I think they're Old Republic has really taken a bunch of the different bank locations in Shakopee. How do you see that as moving forward? Will that trend continue significantly? Is there anything that needs to happen differently that way? Or what are your thoughts just as to what that means for consumers and businesses moving forward?
Madam Chair, Representative, we do think that that will continue at the pace it's been occurring. There's really two parts to it. One is the compliance costs, and it isn't state regulation that's an issue. We hear very little complaint about anything to do with state laws. It's federal laws, especially the Dodd-Frank Act. It applied many, many, many laws the same to community banks as it did to very large banks. And so the cost of compliance with them forces them to consolidate with other banks so that they can afford to hire the people that they need to do that work. The other thing is just IT costs are, you know, in order to keep customer information safe and to offer the kind of things that consumers want now, it's very, very expensive. And so that's been a big challenge for our smaller banks as well, and one other cause of their mergers.
Thank you.
I'm going to follow up. Okay. Other questions? I guess I would have a question then about cybersecurity and planning, and it certainly is something that it continues to be of issue, you know, both at the state level, at the federal level, and in the private sector. So are you anticipating any particular concerns or needs going forward that we have not yet addressed in the state of Minnesota, or are you seeing trends that you anticipate that we're going to have to be looking into with regard to cybersecurity in Minnesota? And that's a big question. So if you need to get back to me, that's okay.
Madam Chair, we could definitely get back to you on that. But, you know, it is something that banks take extremely seriously, and it's very expensive to do it, but they do it. And I don't know that there's any kind of regulation that will help with that. It's just trying to stay one step ahead of the people that are trying to get in, you know. And so there was a situation the other day where the bank was asked to wire money for a commercial customer to a vendor, and the customer gave them the vendor's bank account number. Well, the customer had got the bank account number from their vendor through an email. Well, someone had intercepted the email between the vendor and the customer, changed the account number, and the bank ended up wiring it to this hacker's account number, and you can't get it back. And the bank will end up eating that cost. But that's the kind of thing that is so difficult. I mean, when your customer tells you that this is the right number, and they think it is, but it's not. I mean, it's very difficult. There's, I'm sure you've all seen those kind of phishing emails and all the other kind of things trying to get you to give information, and they know how to use it. So I don't think it's really a government issue right now, though I think any standards that we might have, I'm sure we'd appreciate it if they were, you know, the same in, across the states, you know.
Thank you very much. Seeing no further questions, I thank you both for your time and for the information, and we can look forward to our next presentation from the Minnesota Credit Union Industry, Mr. Cummins, and Ms. Humphrey. And while they're coming to the testifiers table, it's also Credit Union Day at the Capitol. So I think a lot of you have seen credit unions from your district today, including some high school students. I'm looking to see if anybody's in the audience from the high schools, but I'm not seeing them. Welcome. And we always like when the technology works. I always like breathe a sigh of relief. Welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. My name is Mark Cummins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Credit Union Network.
Madam Chair and members, Mara Humphrey, I'm the Vice President of Governmental Affairs and Association Services for the Minnesota Credit Union Network.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all for the opportunity to be here today. We'd like to just provide an overview of our industry. As you can, if I can advance this slide properly.
I spoke too soon.
Okay.
Technology. It's like there are a couple advances.
Usually I'm prohibited from touching technology and chair.
We'll get some help to the table there on the slides.
As we do this, as this slide magically appears, Madam Chair, that will come up. We have, and maybe not magically.
I think we do have them in our packets, so if you want to proceed.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, sorry for that delay. So in Minnesota, we have 107 total number of credit unions that are in the state. Two-thirds of those are state chartered, as you can see. But within those credit unions, there's over 400 branch locations throughout the state, nearly 5,000 employees. As you can see, nearly 2 million people are members of credit unions, and that's a factor that we talk about. That's our industry, our motto of about people helping people. But from a numbers perspective, which is important in the financial industry, there are $23 billion in assets that are entrusted to credit unions to handle for the benefit of their members. So typically a question that I will get is, what is a credit union? And it's, as a financial institution, we are member-owned and not-for-profit cooperatives, which is a mouthful to say, but it's a critical element about us, that we are a not-for-profit industry. That's not a non-profit industry, but it's a not-for-profit industry. In that we have to generate revenues that are used to build capital, which is required so that we can provide that for the protection of the members that we work for. But that money is not owned by the members. It's owned by the institution for the benefit of the membership. So it's a very unique model. So as you can see from that, our governance is elected by the members who constitute the credit unions. Their dividends, if you will, that are paid to them are paid to the members overall. And because of this model and the uniqueness of the model, credit unions do have income tax exemption, corporate income tax exemption, both on the state and for the federal level. So also because of the uniqueness of the model and about institutions that are by people and for people, we provide a number of community benefits. But in the financial sector alone, you can see about $124 million in direct financial benefits. And most of that comes from charging lower rates on loans on average and higher rates on savings as financial benefit. And these are numbers that are in a very compressed interest rate market. If the interest rate market is in a different scenario where there's more spread, if you will, between rates that are paid on savings and rates that are charged on loans, this financial benefit will grow very, very fast in a different environment. So one of our missions as the network, as the trade association for credit unions, is to ensure that everyone who lives in Minnesota has the opportunity to belong to a credit union. However, not everyone can belong to every credit union. There are restrictions in terms of membership to credit unions. We call this internally the field of membership. But there are options in most places by where someone might live in the community that they live, where they work. We have some specific industries, say specific companies such as 3M or General Mills, that if you are an employee there, you're eligible to join that specific credit union. Or if you belong to a group, most of the group areas would be around civic or religious groups, and there are credit unions to serve those. For example, we have three credit unions in Minnesota for folks that are Catholic, as one particular example. So a little bit about our history and the history of credit unions in Minnesota. As you can see, the first credit union, which was Minneapolis Postal Employees Credit Unions, was formed in 1925. So in 1925, we started out with zero assets in credit unions. In 1934 is when the Federal Credit Union Act was passed. That enabled credit unions, as we heard earlier in previous testimony about the dual chartering system, that provided access for credit unions to determine within their business model whether they would want to be state chartered or whether they would want to be federally chartered. So from 1925 through today, you can see we have grown from zero in assets, serving zero people, to nearly 2 million Minnesotans as members of credit unions and $23 billion in assets. So as we talk about this federal versus state charter, one of our principal elements, again, as a trade association in our need, is to ensure that the vibrancy of the state charter, and in our working with you and with Department of Commerce, we've done very well with that. As you heard before in my testimony, two-thirds of credit unions in Minnesota are chartered under the state charter. If you are federal, as you heard previous testimony again, then you are regulated solely by the National Credit Union Administration or NCUA. If you are state chartered, you are regulated by the Department of Commerce and the National Credit Administration for that. The one thing, again, about state chartered credit unions is that they pay an annual assessment for that, and then they pay an hourly fee for the examinations themselves that are done. And it's very critical for our credit unions that we have a strong, dynamic state regulator that does good quality work, as our Department of Commerce does for our credit unions. Our credit unions would even, dare I say this, with it being Credit Union Day, a number of our folks in the room, but if we had the capacity to know that assessment was used solely to regulate credit unions, there probably would be more willingness to pay more for that to ensure that we have quality examinations. If there are non-depository institutions that are also that are not assessed, and they also have to be regulated, so a portion goes towards that. But our folks would very much like to see that assessment be used entirely to regulate credit unions only. All credit unions in Minnesota by state law must be insured by the National Credit Union Administration. That insurance is called the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund. From that, the NCUA is the regulator and overseer for that. So if you are a state chartered credit union, you will be examined also periodically by the NCUA from the safety and soundness perspective and for the protection of the share insurance fund. That insurance is very similar to what you have heard before of the FDIC insurance, and every member then has their shares are insured up to a minimum of $250,000 by the NCUSIF. Again, we have, a very heavily regulated industry. Our examinations that we have are focused on risk. A lot of that risk is about what is also the risk to the share insurance fund. When you say that, then that means that they're ensuring that the safety and soundness of the institution is run in prudent manner for the benefit of their members. Also, All the financial statements for credit unions are filed on a quarterly basis through the call reports. That information is publicly available to anyone that would want to go on the NCUA's website to take a look at that and view that. And we also then have, you see for supervisory committees here, every credit union has a supervisory committee that consists of members, just as the board of directors is members. Some supervisory committees may be elected by the membership. Some are appointed by their elected board of directors. The supervisory committee then is has the broad oversight of the financials for the credit union, but also serves as a body for the members of credit unions to deal with conflict resolution within the credit union itself. So it gives another voice for members if there are instances that they need some help to resolve an issue within their credit union. You can see from this chart some of the growth within the industry. Again, we talk a lot more about people than the dollars that people generate. And in that, you know, the average rate of growth for quite some time in Minnesota of the general population is less than 1%, right around 1%. You can see for the last several years, last 2 years in particular, of growing at 3%. That is part, I think, of just being in Minnesota and the understanding of cooperatives and what that means and what value that can provide to people. And so you see that growth rate that is resonating. And also you can see the high rate of growth in loans that we've had for the last several years of putting money back into our communities for the benefit of our members and the communities in which they serve. One of the unique parts to us as credit unions in that not-for-profit perspective is that we can look uniquely in terms of how we serve our members and how we serve the communities in which our members live. You know, our credit unions have 10 branches that are in schools that are run by students. The first branch, the first student branch, was at Owatonna High School. There are two branches that are in the Cook School District that are in individual K through 12, you know, one building K through 12 school with a student branch run by students. I have been in the classroom with it. One of the things these kids do, which is astounding to me, is they're comfortable enough to go into a classroom and talk to their peers about financial education and being good stewards of their money. And it was something growing up that was something that we were not allowed to even talk about at the dinner table as a family. And yet these students are learning and they have the capacity to talk to each other, to their peer group, about the consequences of taking a credit card for a free T-shirt. And what that means and how that works and what the long-term impacts may be for them. I should say we also have a number of students that are here today that work within those credit unions. We're proud to have that. Another unique aspect of what we do as credit unions is not limited to credit unions to participate in this, but pricing savings legislation was passed recently. This in 2015. This allows for, as a price link savings piece, think of it in terms of as you save money, then you are entered into an opportunity as a drawing to earn more financial reward to be incentivized for that. So the way this program works is we've trademarked it as incentive, is that for each $25 increment in growth of your account at the end of the month, you get an entry into a prize pool for that. So over the last several years now, we're at $6 million that have been saved through this. This is targeting people that don't save money. You know, as a financial institution, if you were doing a program to encourage deposits into your institution, $6 million is not a lot of money. But when you're doing that for folks that don't save money at all, $6 million is significant. And you can see that the average balance here is under $900 for these folks that are participants that are in this program. But it's just another element of the financial education that we do. You know, I received an email this morning from one of our credit unions in the Brainerd area that was talking about this story of They have a community outreach person within the credit union who's doing financial education training for teen mothers. And the story really is that she was telling them that you need to try to save. If you save just as little as $5 a month, it can make a difference for your future. And so now, 2 years later, the same individual, the instructor from the credit union, is working with a social worker still with these teen mothers. And the story that she was relating was that this teen mother then had a flat tire in her car. So the social worker did work with her to figure out how they can get the money to pay for it to fix this flat so she can continue to work. And the teen mother tells her social worker, you don't need to worry about that. You know, that lady that came to talk to us before told me to save $5 a month. I have the money. I can do this myself. You know, those are the little kinds of things that can be done that make a significant difference in the lives of people within this state. Similarly, we have made available a number of different opportunities for assistance during the government shutdown from our credit. We do this because that's what we do. We serve members from doing SCIFA payment opportunities where there's no fee for doing that. A number of our credits reached out directly to their members and said, every situation is unique. Come and talk to us so that we can determine what is the best program that we can put together for you. You know, similarly for the bill that will be heard later today, we support the bill from the credit union industry. But it's one of those things for us, it's like, but this is what we do. We don't have to have special opportunities to do it. This is what we do every day for the people that we serve and for the benefit of our members. This is what we were designed to do, what Congress gave us the enabling legislation to create. So we appreciate the support. We appreciate the committee looking at other ways to reach out to people in Minnesota to be of help on financial matters. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you for the presentation and the information. Are there any questions from committee members? Well, we thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we have another presentation. Anna Odegaard and Claudia Holtz would like to come to the table. Thank you. And we just want to be sure that this information is all very good, but want to be sure we get to hear from everybody. So it's about 3 o'clock now. So I'm not sure how long your presentation is, 10 minutes or?
Exactly.
Perfect. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the legislative advocate for the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk today about the role of nonprofit organizations in building financial capability in our communities. We are a statewide coalition of 140 nonprofit organizations, and we're dedicated to increasing opportunities for lower and moderate income Minnesotans to build assets for long-term financial prosperity and independence. Our member organizations are primarily direct service providers offering a range of asset building services. As a coalition, we advocate for policies and public investments that ensure that all Minnesotans have access to both financial knowledge and skills, as well as appropriate financial services and products to support effective money management at any income level. Nonprofit organizations work strategically to bridge the gap between the families we serve and financial tools that can help strengthen their finances. These efforts often involve partnerships with financial institutions, as Teresa mentioned just a few moments ago. And these partnerships really leverage the trusting relationships that nonprofit organizations have with their communities to connect their clients to safe and appropriate financial services and products that help them build a brighter financial future. For many nonprofit clients, access to low-fee savings and transactional accounts is an important first step because it can reduce the transactional costs of dealing in cash, such as using check cashing services or purchasing money orders to pay bills. Individuals may be reluctant to approach a mainstream financial institution on their own, possibly because of a language barrier, just lack of familiarity with what's available or what to ask for, or previous banking problems. Nonprofits have been at the forefront of integrating financial capability services at free tax preparation sites, partnering with banks or credit unions to offer low-fee savings and transactional accounts to tax site clients for direct deposit of a tax refund. In combination with individualized financial coaching, this is really an effective way for nonprofits to facilitate access to safe financial products and support clients as they build familiarity with financial institutions while helping them avoid more costly products like refund anticipation loans. Nonprofits also know that many of our clients want to build savings, as the gentleman just mentioned, that $5 a month, and that many of them are willing to make sacrifices to do so but have limited income to meet their savings goals. Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota, that are known as the FAME program, which I know some of you are familiar with, is a matched savings program for low-income families. Participants save $40 per month for 24 months, and those savings are matched by federal and state funds. At the end of 2 years, those savings accumulated are about $4,000 and can be used to reach their higher education goals, a down payment on a residence, or to support a small business. Participants have also then built a two-year relationship with the bank or credit union where their savings are housed, and they've established a savings habit. 23 nonprofits in Minnesota offer the FAME program and have served over 900 clients since 2016. Nonprofits also recognize that many of our clients struggle with low credit scores and can benefit both from education about how credit scores affect many aspects of their financial security and also from concrete credit building opportunities. Many nonprofits offer financial education workshops along with small, low-interest credit building loans to in order to boost credit scores while building financial knowledge and supporting effective money management skills. Lending circles are another model for helping clients access credit while building a credit history. Nonprofits often organize from 6 to 12 clients for a lending circle where each participant contributes an equal amount to a loan fund each month, with each month's total then being provided as a loan to one of the members until each member has their turn. This model enables nonprofits to report to credit bureaus, effectively boosting credit scores for all of their participants while creating affordable access to capital. For individuals struggling with debt, some nonprofits offer free certified credit and debt counseling to help clients make informed decisions about managing their debt. A few nonprofits have even started using their own loan funds to help transition people from more costly high-interest loans to zero-interest loans, along with the opportunity for individualized financial coaching. These are just a few examples of the work going on in the nonprofit sector. I wish we had time for you to hear success stories from every nonprofit working on financial capability in your communities. We are lucky to have Claudia Holt here from Prepare and Prosper to talk about the groundbreaking work that they are doing in the metro area. Before I turn it over to Claudia, I just want to bring your attention briefly to the Prosperity Now scorecard that should be in your folders. Prosperity Now is a national policy and research organization focused on financial capability, and their scorecard, which literally was released today, is just an interesting snapshot of how Minnesota is doing, and it's really very well on several measures of financial health. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you just would reintroduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Claudia Holt, and I'm the Financial Capability Manager at Prepare and Prosper. Thanks for inviting me to provide information to this committee about the barriers that impede financial capability and the services Prepare and Prosper offers in our community. Prepare and Prosper is a nonprofit organization focused on building pathways to financial well-being and economic opportunity for low and moderate income households. We offer free tax preparation, financial services, and financial coaching to help customers access financial systems and tools and leverage them to increase their financial well-being. Our approach to this work is two-pronged. We help customers increase their financial well-being through direct services, as well as advocate for policies and systems that support financial stability, security, and inclusion. Despite earning a regular paycheck, many households struggle with making that paycheck stretch to meet all their obligations. This can cause a cascade of stressors, as finances are deeply entwined with every aspect of a person's life, and financial stress can have negative impact on everything from job performance to physical health. Sometimes there's simply not enough income to make ends meet, but sometimes the problem is not knowing how to manage what you have. Financial systems can be complicated and mysterious. The average family earning $25,000 per year without a bank account spends $1,200 to $2,400 per year on financial transactions and may not be aware of the options for avoiding those costs. A young person just starting out with a steady job may qualify for a credit card, but many aren't told that charging anything beyond 30% of the available balance can hurt your credit score. They may not know that landlords, employers, and insurance companies can look at your credit to make decisions that affect your financial life. Many people don't realize that a person with a poor driving history and perfect credit pays less for car insurance than a person with a perfect driving record and bad credit. They may not realize that a free checking account is only free if you can maintain a minimum balance on a daily basis or make a certain number of debit card transactions each month. In each of these examples, better understanding of financial systems can help people manage their finances more effectively. On the other hand, just knowing how the system works doesn't make it easier to abide by all the rules. Just as a doctor telling you to eat healthier food and exercise doesn't make it easier to get yourself to the gym. Most people want to make the best decisions they can for their families, but moving from intent to action is easier said than done and can sometimes be cost prohibitive. Everyone knows you shouldn't overdraft your bank account, but what happens when the damage is already done? Overdraft fees or poor credit often lead individuals being excluded from opening bank accounts. Also, just knowing the importance of good credit score isn't enough without opportunities for credit building. According to the FDIC, 328,000 households in Minnesota are unbanked or underbanked, meaning they operate entirely or partially outside of mainstream banking and have little to no access to products and services to protect and build assets and wealth. This issue disproportionately affects households of color. Over several years, Prepare and Prosper, with support from leaders from a cross-section of foundations, nonprofits, city governments, and financial institutions, has been working on an innovative solution to the problems of financial inclusion and insecurity, such as volatile incomes and low wages, poor or no credit, high fees charged by financial transactions, and more. In partnership with Sunrise Banks, we've developed the Financial Access in Reach, or FAIR, initiative, which is a collaborative approach to addressing these problems. We offer checking and savings account to people regardless of banking history with no minimum balance and low predictable fees. We also offer a credit builder loan with no minimum credit score. We work with trusted distribution partners so people can open accounts right where they live and work with people who they can trust. We also offer ongoing support and coaching to set people up for success in their accounts and help them achieve their goals. Most financial institutions do not have the capacity to offer the hands-on coaching and support that nonprofits like ours are able to offer. Programs like FAIR and our financial coaching program meet people where they're at and can spend the time to unravel complicated financial situations, offering resources and support when people need it the most. We can demystify financial systems and help people develop a plan that they can stick to, acting as a cheerleader along the way. In our financial coaching program, called Money Mentors, our volunteer coaches meet monthly with participants to set goals and develop action plans to meet those goals. Sometimes the issues people are facing are complex, but other times participants just need someone to go through their monthly expenses and see where they can find some savings within their budget. If a participant is hesitant about contacting a debt collector, our coaches can sit with them while they make the call and reassure them that they're asking the right questions. Hopefully, our hands-on work with participants can make them better equipped to deal with those financial shocks that might come up. I recently got an email from one of our coaching participants that I'd like to share. This particular woman has been trying to get into low-income senior housing for a very long time, and she writes, I'm embarrassed to say that over the years, I was just waiting for my credit score to become better. Money Mentors has taught me that I had to be proactive and work on my credit. I hadn't realized how much weight a credit score carries, especially to rental properties. I thought my 20-year tenant history would be of value. I was unaware that my credit score was the key factor. You've helped me see where I lost so much money on non-refundable application fees. Thank you for all you do to help folks see the big picture and help people become empowered. So this person is going to get enrolled in our credit building product so that hopefully they can boost their score before they continue applying for housing facilities where they keep getting rejected. Prepare and Prosper is working hard to meet the needs of underserved members of our community, but we cannot do it alone. We can do so much more in collaboration with nonprofit, government, and private sector leaders. Financial capability is every sector's problem and every sector's opportunity. We are delighted that this committee is asking these questions so that we can find solutions to these issues and build healthier communities. The first pilot phase of FAIR was made possible in part because of support from the legislature, and we will continue to ask you to partner with us to help make these opportunities available in our communities. Our executive director, Tracy Fishman, and others from Prepare and Prosper are excited to share more in the future. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Does anybody have questions? Very interesting, and appreciate the information, and look forward to hearing more throughout the session.
Thank you.
And next on our list of presentations is Ron Elwood from Legal Service Advocacy Project. Would love to invite you down. I know that you are have just a few brief remarks you wanted to share with the committee, and I think it's a good opportunity for everybody to get to know all the folks that they're going to be meeting throughout the session. So welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and maybe a future member of the body over there. My name is Ron Elwood. I'm with Legal Aid. So I'm really honored to be asked to describe today the many ways in which Minnesota has been a leader in financial consumer protection. I'm going to break the Minnesota rule and brag on us for just 2 minutes. I think the hallmark of the highlights that I'm going to present just for a second is really the way in which these statutes and laws have been enacted here. They've been done in a bipartisan manner through collaboration in the financial sector anyway with the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, the Independent Bankers, Minnesota Independent Bankers of Minnesota, Legal Aid, AARP, and others. So I think that's an important message, and we've done this to advance consumer protection while being mindful of not placing unnecessary regulatory impediments to the way we conduct responsible banking and financial services here. Over the years, Minnesota has passed, you have, this committee, and the legislature has passed landmark legislation that you should all know about, some of which you probably do, some of which you might not. Way back when, at the beginning of the foreclosure crisis, when sort of the canary in the coal mine, we had the equity stripping scams where people would knock on people's doors and say, hey, I can save your home, deed your home back to me, deed your home over to me, I'll give you contract for deed, lease, give you a rental, and then, of course, they were designed to fail, and the people would not only lose all the payments but all the equity in their house. They were just stolen. And so that law was passed in 2004, expanded in 2009 to include the loan mod scams that had cropped up, and in 2015 again to include family farmers in this. The foreclosure crisis is the best example of bipartisanship and collaboration. Again, the same parties, the Bankers Association, the Credit Union Networks, Legal Aid, state agencies, including the Department of Commerce, spent from 2008 to 2013, every year coming back here passing laws to protect homeowners and trying to keep them in their homes, including the landmark anti-predatory lending bill in 2007. You've done a great job in passing legislation to protect elders and our vulnerable adults from financial exploitation. And just last year, I'll conclude in the brief remarks to talk about the prevention of financial abuse against service members and surviving spouses, a bill that Representative Davids was co-author of last year, created a prohibition against taking assignments of pay and benefits away from service members against these very high-priced loans. And finally, last year, another piece of landmark legislation, the PACE bill. The property assessed clean energy. There were these loans that were putting people potentially in danger in California and Florida. Representative O'Driscoll carried that bill. It was co-authored here by Representative Haley, Representative Davids. And these are just a handful of the things that this committee and this legislature has done to protect consumers. And I really appreciate the time that you've given me to just highlight your great work over the years.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Any questions for Mr. Elwood? Seeing none, thanks again. With that, we can move into hearing our first bill from our committee, and Representative Stevens can make his way to the testifiers table. While he does, we can take a walk down memory lane, and Representative O'Driscoll, I know that PACE bill came together really quickly, didn't it, and was super easy. Well, thanks for your work on it. Representative Stevens, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
As a member of the committee, you can move your own bill, so if you'd like to move your bill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move that the committee re-refer this bill to Ways and Means at this time.
And Representative Stevens, I believe that we also need to move the recommendation that it be referred to Jobs,
to the Jobs Committee
and Economic Development Finance.
Thank you.
All right, we're on the record officially.
We're good.
Excellent.
All right.
And I see you have an amendment as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would also move that the committee adopt the DE1 amendment, which was distributed yesterday. And I'm happy to explain that amendment. This gets the bill sort of in the shape that I'd like the committee to consider it. As members of the committee might be aware, this is sort of a time-sensitive bill that was moving quickly through the drafting phase. I asked the revisor's office to move pretty quickly to get this together. They had some technical changes they wanted to make. Deed and Commerce also reviewed the bill after it was jacketed and had some changes that they recommended. And there's a few other things that I will mention as I discuss the bill in greater detail. But mostly this is just to get the bill in the shape that I'd like the committee to consider it in.
Okay. And so did you move the DE1?
I would. If I didn't already, I would move the DE1 amendment.
Representative Stevens moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. And two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Pass it around.
The federal government shutdown that just ended last week was the longest in the history of the United States. It lasted 35 days. Employees of the federal government, as a consequence, missed two paychecks during that time period. Fortunately, the federal government did pass a law indicating that those workers would receive back pay, but it was enormously disruptive to their lives and to their communities during the time that the shutdown was ongoing. The shutdown also had a profound effect on Minnesota. In Minnesota, we have 17,000 federal employees, 6,000 of which were furloughed or forced to work without pay. A non-comprehensive list of agencies that have employees in Minnesota that were impacted by the shutdown, where they were furloughed or forced to work without pay, would include our TSA agents, our air traffic controllers, the FBI, our U.S. Attorney's Office, our federal prisons in Rochester, Waseca, and Sandstone, and our food inspectors. We can disagree on who was responsible for the shutdown or how we should have gotten out of it, but we should all be able to agree that it's wrong to put our federal workforce through financial suffering. And that's why myself and Senator Little, who I believe is in the gallery there, are offering the bill here to try and give some relief to federal workers impacted by shutdown. Now, of course, the shutdown ended last Friday. But as I think the members of the committee are likely aware, the resolution was only for 3 weeks. And absent another act of Congress, we will be back in a shutdown now in a little, more than 2 weeks. And I think that is a real possibility. In fact, the president tweeted on January 26th, quote, 21 days goes by quickly. And I think that's very true. The president also told the Wall Street Journal on Sunday that he put the odds of reaching an agreement on border security at less than 50-50 and said that another shutdown is, quote, certainly an option. So the bill that is before you today is still timely because the threat of the shutdown is still very real for our federal employees, and the underlying policy disputes that led to the shutdown are unresolved, and there's no sign that they will be resolved. So what does this bill do? It creates a public-private partnership to allow federal employees affected by shutdowns to receive interest, to take interest-free loans. Private banks lend the money. The loans are guaranteed by the state. The amount of the loan that the employee is eligible to take is the lesser of $5,000 or the employee's after-tax monthly income. The employee can take three loans, one every 30 days. No interest can accrue on the loans during the shutdown or during the 90-day grace period following the shutdown, After the grace period, there's a 180-day period in which interest can accrue, and the bank can make collection efforts in accordance with their own collection policies. This is an area where we clarified in the author's amendment the specifics of how that timetable works. As I mentioned, the program is administered by deed. Another amendment adds a dollar figure onto this amount of $2.5 million transferred from the general fund to deed to cover the guarantee. That figure comes from assuming that every single federal employee affected by the shutdown takes out the maximum amount that they conceivably could be eligible for, $15,000, and then there's a default rate of 3%. I think that every piece of that calculation is on the conservative side. I don't think that every federal government employee would participate. I don't think they take out the maximum amount. I don't think that there'll be a default rate of 3%, but that's where the $2.5 million figure comes from. Any bank or credit union can participate. This is another area that the amendment clarifies. The original bill had a much broader definition that would have been open to, for example, payday lenders. We are narrowing it now to banks and credit unions. Many banks have expressed interest. You'll hear from one today, Sunrise Banks. Rick Beeson will be testifying in a minute. I also want to take this moment to commend Sunrise for how quickly they came to the table to work on this bill. And frankly, there's a lot of members of our corporate community here in Minnesota who have been working hard to help our federal employees weather the shutdown with or without state action, and they should be applauded for that as well. You'll also hear from a minute from a few federal workers who were impacted by the shutdown, and they'll tell you about how difficult it was for them and how this program would have helped them during that shutdown and could help in a potential future shutdown. During last fall's campaign, the people I spoke to expressed their extreme disgust with the partisan gamesmanship that has come to dominate Washington, D.C., and frankly, increasingly, St. Paul. The federal government shutdown is a clear example of what they find so objectionable, particularly as it impacts real people who work every day to serve Minnesotans, keep us safe, protect our food, keep our economy strong. This bill is a chance to protect those everyday Minnesotans who happen to work in the federal government from the partisan wrangling that we all hate. And with that, I would turn over to our testifiers. I think first, Mr. Beeson, if you wanted to come up and speak, if the chair is okay with that approach.
Yes, please come down. And Representative Stevenson, we do have a couple questions from members.
And I'm happy to take those now or at the conclusion of the testimony at the at chair's discretion.
Representative Garofalo was first. Is your question, do you want to hear from testifiers or would you like to ask your question now?
Why don't we wrap, Madam Chair, why don't we wrap through the testifiers?
Okay.
But I do want to compliment you on these nice new cushy chairs that we have. This DFL majority thing ain't so bad after all, huh? This is pretty nice.
I might have mentioned to the previous chair that there were new chairs this session, and we looked for chairs for a real long time. So glad you're comfortable. And Representative Swazinski, is that acceptable to you? Then we will proceed with testifiers, and hopefully we can keep our testimony to a little under 5 minutes at the most, if that works for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Beeson with Sunrise Banks. We are located in 6 locations in Minneapolis and St. Paul, including the foothills of the state capitol in the Frogtown neighborhood. So on behalf of our bank and the almost 300 banks in Minnesota, we're excited to be talking to the legislature and our trade group about participating in this program. And as was mentioned, there are a number of bank-initiated programs already in place, and many banks, frankly, just as a course of doing business, deal with emergency situations and issues with exceptions. So skipping a payment or lowering an interest rate or making an advance on the payroll or whatever it takes is really what we do every day. It doesn't get any headline, but that's the practical important work that we do. So you wonder why do we, with all that, why do we need a program like this? My experience has been that there are many people who have a fear or a hesitancy about coming into a bank or a credit union for fear of rejection, particularly if they're out of a job. And having a program that has a state participation, I think, will bring people in. The element that I particularly like about this program, frankly, is that it does require financial counseling. We, as a course of business, have a contract with Lutheran Social Services in Minnesota, who's got have offices all over the state, and they help folks with budgeting and with planning, because everybody needs a financial plan. Everybody has an emergency at some point, and this really helps people beyond just getting some money, but helping them reset their financial picture. So I'm open to any questions. Thank you, members, and Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Would you like to have your next testifier
come in? Yes.
Any questions for this particular testifier, or we can wait? We can wait.
Okay. Next, Madam Chair, I'd ask if Celia Hahn, who works for the Transportation Security Administration, was impacted by the shutdown.
Ms. Hahn, welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
My name is Celia Hahn. I'm a transportation security officer at Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Thank you very much for having me here today. I'm just going to speak briefly on how the shutdown has affected me and my coworkers at Minneapolis-St. Paul. Yesterday would have been payday for us, so that was the second paycheck that we've missed. We are expecting pay this week, though, which is good, but there's still a lot of anxiety that we're just going to wind up right back here in 3 weeks. So for the last 5 weeks or so, everybody's at work has just been making really tough choices. We've been working, and life has been going on. We've still had to pay for daycare, put gas in our cars to get to work, groceries on the table, mortgage, car payments, all medical stuff, all that good stuff. The biggest concerns have been not coming out whole at the end of this thing. Nobody wants to put everything on our credit cards and risk huge interest amounts or take out loans. Or I've heard some people discussing payday loans, and I know that's not a good idea. Really, this legislation would be a huge relief to people to have a place to go to get money to help stay on top of the bills and not get too far behind in the process of doing other things. So hopefully it's something that's considered. Otherwise, I don't have that much more to say other than that.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your work keeping us safe when we fly. I'm sorry that you had to go this long without paychecks. So thank you for coming to share your story. Representative Stevenson, I know you have another testifier.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have one more testifier, Neil Hoadley, who is an Airway Transportation System Specialist with the Federal Aviation Administration. He's also the District Representative for the Airway Professional Aviation Safety Specialists.
Okay. Mr. Hoadley, welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Neil Hoadley. I'm a member of the Professional Aviation Safety Specialists. We're called PASS. And I serve as an aviation transportation system specialist currently at Rochester Airport. I used to work at Minneapolis. In my position, my responsibilities include maintaining instrument landing systems, navigational aids, weather broadcasting systems, and performing non-federal system inspections, such as those systems that are operated at municipal airports in the state of Minnesota. We represent the aviation safety inspectors, the system specialists, the aeronautical professionals, and administrative support staff who install, maintain, and certify and inspect every aspect of the nation's aviation system. We are dedicated to preserving the safety of the system and the flying public above all else. The flight standards people who were furloughed include aviation safety inspectors who oversee every aspect of the aviation industry to ensure adherence to aviation FAA regulations and safety standards. They're the ones that inspected the aircrafts, pilots, the safety practices to keep everybody safe. And when they were one of the first ones that were told to be furloughed, which removed a vital level of safety throughout the system. For us and our group, we're all over Minnesota. Our service centers are in Duluth, Grand Forks, Southeast Minnesota, St. Paul, Minneapolis Airport, the center at Farmington. Southeast Dakota serves the southwest portion of Minnesota, and Fargo serves the western central part of it. for us, a lot of us started ahead of time. We knew this was coming. We had this bad feeling that nobody was going to get close. So believe it or not, even though we had to plan for our mortgages and car payments, that wasn't the biggest problem. You have other commitments, gas for work, insurance payments, stressing over whether you're going to have some kind of medical condition before it happens, and then it snows, and all of a sudden you're wondering if you got to wear spikes out in the snow. It was always about that unforeseen item that could end you up in a food line. When you talk about financial institutions, what we found out when we were doing research, since I am the district pass rep and have five states, we found out that Minnesota immediately, when we started looking for financial institutions, just about every one of them had a banner up telling what they were going to do for us. They're telling us now we're going to get paid. We're not so happy about it because last November on the National Day of Mourning, the FAA had a bunch of people in training. We have a big Oklahoma City training center, a lot of logistics, a lot of personnel down there. We also had our contractor training centers. So on the National Day of Mourning, they had no way of allowing these people to go take the day off, which was normal in training. And there's a common thread that if you're in training, you always observe the holidays. So these guys ended up working. The FAA decided not to pay them for holiday work. And so we had to take them to court just to see if we can get them paid for 8 hours. And that's why, for us, it's personal a little bit. We have a lack of trust in how we're going to get paid. Yesterday, when they first told us how we were going to get paid, it was going to be at 60%. So we're going to get 60% on Wednesday for the past paycheck. Today's one of our paydays. We're supposed to get 60% Thursday for that paycheck, and then we're supposed to get some big lump sum on the next normal payday. And everybody's like, you know, that's going to create a problem. So then today, or late yesterday, it came about, no, we're not getting 60%. We're getting 50% now for the missed payday on Wednesday. We're getting our first 50%. For the paycheck that we're missing today, we're getting our second 50%. And then on Friday, the remaining amount for both of those missed paychecks, they're going to give us whatever's left over after they take every deduction out of it for what was missed. This is going to be your 401k savings, any 401k loans, your medicals, your insurances, your retirements, all of it. The problem for a lot of people is that we have a lot of married couples. I myself, my wife was a transportation security officer at the TSA at Minneapolis. She ended up on medical retirement because of a heart attack, and we were living off of that. That's what we had for a month. I had some savings, and we had planned ahead of time, so I wasn't in near as bind as a lot of other people. One of the groups that fell through the cracks a lot was our new hires. A lot of them didn't have certifications. A lot of them moved here, and a lot of them, as you can imagine, tried to get into government service from other states. So they take a job in Minnesota, they come here, they're married, they buy a house, and he's still going to school down in Oklahoma City, and all of a sudden there's a furlough. He gets furloughed with a brand new house and is told to go home and wait. And that's some of the people that fell through the cracks. This program, I think, would not only help the banks cover themselves, but it also helps us. As the representative said, we have no confidence that come February 15th, things are going to go back to normal. We hope, we hear about all the laws and rules in national government, but unlike you guys, they don't come home. They don't have to go home at night and visit, and basically we know where you guys live. It's interesting that things in Washington don't go near as fast as what they do out here, and I am greatly appreciative at the Representative Stevenson for coming up with this and the fact that you guys are moving it forward as fast as you are. Thanks.
Thanks for your testimony. And Representative Stevenson, if you are ready, we can move to member questions unless you have anybody else specified this time.
Madam Chair, I didn't have any other test questions that I brought. I know that Jim Amundson from the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota had signed up to testify, and I understand that they had some questions and feedback that we were able to discuss in the hallway at the outset of this hearing, and we're going to meet and talk about those further. If Mr. Amundson wants to testify, certainly happy to hear that. We're also, as I mentioned, we are going to meet, so I move that to him.
Welcome to the committee. And you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Halverson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Jim Amundson, and I'm the President and CEO of the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, or ICBM as we're known in short. I will try to shorten this up quite a bit in the interest of time, and as Representative Stevenson indicated, we did have a chance to have a conversation out in the hallway during the early part of the committee meeting, and we'll get together again in the near future here. Just want to offer up that I bring my comments as with 25 years of experience as a community banker. I've been in this role about 3 years, and then would offer the comments of our membership, board, legislative committee, and others. I want to start out being clear that I want to commend Representative Stevenson and the committee on your spirit of service, your desire to solve problems, and your goal of helping Minnesotans who need help. This is exactly how community banks operate each and every day, as you've heard from others prior to me today. But I'd like to highlight that we do so because it's at the very core of our business, not because there's a program established by any government or regulatory agency, but it's in the very fiber of who we are and what we do. So as been mentioned previously, prior to drafting this bill, community banks were already helping, and they continue to help their customers affected by the shutdown of the federal government. Because they know their customers, they're already using the well-established tools available to them, extensions of new credit, waiving fees, easing existing credit limits, payment deferrals, and other loan modifications, just to name a few. And these are happening within the current regulatory environment and compliance structure in ways that serve their customers and fit the system's policies and risk management structures of their banks. And I should point out that these things are happening for not only furloughed federal workers, but those who are experiencing any other sort of hardship in their communities. And again, all done without a program or a government guarantee. Having said that, I want to be very clear, community banks want to support this bill and others like it as we work with all of you to improve the lives of Minnesota residents. Shortly after the press conference last Friday, I did have a chance to speak with staff at Deed, and I did express our general support of the concept. It was quite early in the process, and as you all know, it's been moving along quickly. Since that time, I've had a chance to have some conversations with a number of our members, and the feedback I have today, which I will shorten quite a bit, is really based on those comments. And as I told Representative Stevenson, not to oppose the bill in any way, but only to try to make it as effective as possible, and that these are the items that came up consistently from our members in terms of challenges that they may see or things that may get in the way of them participating. First, loan documentation, payment schedules, disclosures, and without getting too deep into the weeds, the bill as drafted provides very specific terms regarding the grace period, interest, and loan repayment. For a bank to prepare loan documents, give the borrower required disclosures and have those disclosures be accurate, some of the information, required information, consists of the date repayment begins, the amount of interest paid, and the maturity date of the loan. If another shutdown occurs and this bill is signed into law, at the time of the loan origination, some of the key terms won't be able to be defined because we won't know at the time of loan origination when the shutdown may end. We don't know when the grace period may begin. We don't know when interest payments may begin or if they ever begin. And so just a little more time. I'm not saying that's insurmountable, and some of the larger institutions may have the tools to have already jumped over that hurdle, but for our members, that's a question, is how do you put these disclosures together with that many unknowns at the front end of it. Again, as it relates to fair lending laws, community banks spend a lot of time working on fair lending laws, and for a lot of reasons, a lot of good reasons. However, the laws have been applied somewhat inconsistently and at times somewhat aggressively from various agencies. And one of the key messages is simply don't treat certain groups differently than others. And we'd want to just have a little time to consult with primary regulators and make sure that by perhaps making underwriting exceptions for one particular group and not making those same underwriting exceptions for another group, that we're not creating fair lending issues for our banks. Underwriting considerations in the best interest of the customer, again, in talking to Representative Stevenson, as we look at this, you know, if the assumption is that these individuals are experiencing a hardship as a result of the federal government shutdown, and that they either don't have or they have already exhausted any personal savings, and they're experiencing needs beyond other existing support structures like unemployment insurance or other items. Given that assumption, if that's true, and the fact that an individual could accumulate up to, if we have a really record shutdown, 90-day shutdown, up to $15,000 of debt, that's a significant amount for an individual who maybe has exhausted their any liquid savings they have, is, you know, experiencing admittedly a hardship. The question then becomes repayment and how are those loans repaid, and as it's drafted with no more than six equal installments, if a person has the maximum $15,000, that's six payments of $2,500 a piece. Depending on, as the gentleman before me mentioned, depending on the schedule of the payment of that back pay, I guess it would be our recommendation that we try to find a way to tie the payment of that back pay, if it is a bridge for that time when they're not receiving it, to the repayment of the loan, and maybe not have it extend as long as it's proposed in the existing language. And finally, Representative Stevenson,
I was going to ask you just if you can wrap your comments up, because I want to be sure we get to member questions. And we're
the all-or-nothing guarantee structure, and maybe that's changing a little bit with some of the assumptions and the specific allocation of $2.5 million, but to go into it with the potential of having that fund exhausted by the time a bank comes around to try collect on the guarantee would be a concern for some of the members participating in the program. So in closing, I want to emphasize that we want to be a partner. We want to support the bill and help. I just wanted to, you know, again, commend Representative Stevenson and the committee. And if there are things that we can do to help improve the bill, we'd be happy to serve as a resource. So thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I would like to move to member questions. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, this is a serious topic and it merits a serious discussion, but I'm wondering if I could just have a little bit of fun for a second here before we move on to this. Members, as you know, there's a tradition in this body of freshmen bringing treats for their first hearing before a committee. And Representative Stevenson, I want to tell you that your treat choice today was the bare minimum of acceptable. And Madam Chair, if I could just ask one question before we move on to the serious nature of the bill. Representative Stevenson, my network of spies tells me that, in fact, these are leftovers, that you actually passed these treats around in an earlier committee today. Is that true?
Well, it is true that I had another committee hearing right before this, and I did bring Oreos to that committee. I think that your feedback is noted, and I think probably the next time I have a bill, I will have to do a do-over and bring something to this committee.
And Representative Garofalo, I do need to note, in defense of Representative Stevenson, they are double-stuffed.
That's the bare minimum, Madam Chair, bare minimum, and I suspect I'll take the author at his guidance there, that he'll do better next time. Let that be a lesson to all you other first-term DFLers, okay?
Representative Katisa-Watoon, actually.
Madam Chair, my boys have no complaints about
okay. Double. Thank you. There you go.
Double stuff.
Sure. Representative Grapple.
Okay, so thank you. So it is a serious topic, though, so let's get back to the more serious nature of this. Representative Stevenson, you're only applying this to federal employees. Why not federal contractors?
I think that they're. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. I think the reason for that is that there gets into a kind of a gray area of what constitutes a federal contractor. Sometimes contractors who work for multiple different entities, they might do only a small portion of their work for the federal government or a significant portion of their work. The bill was drafted, you know, as time being a major consideration. Some of those ideas, which have merit, I certainly want to make sure that federal contractors are also being compensated fairly. But it's harder to come up with some of those definitions and would take more time than we had at the time. The other thing that I would point out, there's a pretty important distinction between federal employees and federal contractors in that federal employees, there was a federal law that was passed during the shutdown indicating that they would get back pay. There has been no legislation like that for federal contractors passed. I know that Senator Tina Smith is authoring some legislation right now that I think has bipartisan support, and I would certainly hope that it would happen. But that's the reason why this bill is limited to federal employees at this time.
Representative Garofalo, follow up.
Madam Chair, and so I just have a couple of questions, if that's okay. Madam Chair, and to the author, so we are delineating in statute that some people who are impacted by the federal shutdown are going to get assistance, but other people who are paid through the federal government are not going to be impacted by the shutdown. I think that's a problem, and it's one that needs addressing. Second of all, with regards to the bill, how much are you allowing Deed to withhold for administrative costs?
Representative Stevenson.
That is a great question. Right now we have a fiscal note that has been requested that's in process, and so I think we don't have a good assessment yet of how much the administrative costs will be from Deed, and I think that's something that we'll address in the Jobs Committee when we look at when we have a fiscal note, we can look at that.
Thank you, and that is true. The next stop is a Finance Committee, and so we will that will be an appropriate question for that committee.
Okay. Madam Chair, and then
Representative Groff.
To the author, there's 6,000 federal workers in the state of Minnesota right now. Assuming that there were average loans of $2,500 apiece, this pot of resources would be available for about 15% of workers. Is that your intent?
So the money that's in the, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the amount of money that's in there is only to fund the guarantee. The funds themselves are distributed by the banks. So the $2.5 million is not a reflection of the full amount of funds that would be available to employees. It's just a reflection of how much we think might be necessary to guarantee those loans. And as I indicated in the remarks, the way we get to that $2.5 million is by assuming that every single eligible federal employee, and as you note, there are 17,000 federal employees, 6,000 affected by the shutdown. If you assume that all 6,000 took out the maximum amount that the statute allows, $15,000, and then defaulted at a rate of 3%, that's where you get to the $2.5 million.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Two more questions. Number one, to the author, are banks allowed to withhold administrative fees from these proceeds?
Representative Stevenson.
Again, the proceeds only are from the guarantee, are only a guarantee. So the bank only gets the money if the borrower defaults on the loan. The banks are going to be issuing their loans in accordance with their own lending practices, and they will handle their administrative fees in connection with that.
So, Madam Chair and the author, the government gets their cut on the front side and it's guaranteed, but not the private sector facilitators. My final question is that on page one, in the listing of this, the shutdown is defined as any government action occurring during calendar year 2019. Yet in the final bill, the final page of the bill, we see that these funds are actually encumbered at the department until not only the end of fiscal year 20, but carries forward into August 1st, 2021. Given that these resources are going to be tied up, why would you only limit it to an event this year? Why wouldn't you not expand it to 2020? Why did you do that?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that's an excellent question. The answer is kind of relates back to your earlier question about federal contractors. There needs to be probably a more thorough discussion about what would trigger the applicability of this bill in a future time period. And so we wanted to limit it close in time so that we could have a good handle on how much money we would need and how many people would be impacted. If you move beyond 2019, you're entering a new budget year for the federal government, and that could represent a whole different population of federal workers that might be impacted. And beyond that, to answer your question as to why the funds don't be returned until 2021, that was Deed's comment, that they wanted to have the extra time to ensure that the guarantee would be fully processed.
All right. Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I have concerns with this bill. I don't like the substance of it. I certainly don't like the tones of it. I'll be voting no today. I would urge my colleagues to do so. And next time, Representative Stevenson, just bring better treats. It'll go a lot better. Thank you.
Fair enough.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of start on the light note, too, you know, the treats are an opportunity for to showcase your district, right? You bring something good from your district that showcases what is made in your district. Unless Oreos are made in your district, you know, just you know, it's a great, you know, Schwann's ice cream, whatever.
People in Champlain and Coon Rapids like Oreos.
That's good. That's good. So, but just kind of moving on from that point, but just from a, so to get this correct, for a bank to participate, does the state underwrite the interest? Because it's in your bill, it says it's an interest-free loan.
No, the guarantee is of the principal.
So, but thank you, Madam Chair. So, the loan must be interest-free in order to participate.
The loan must be. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Swizinski. The loan must be interest-free during the pendency of the shutdown and during the 90 days grace period that follows the end of the shutdown.
Representative Swizinski, follow up.
So, in order to qualify, the loan needs to be interest-free. So the bank needs to not charge interest. So it's an interest-free, but there's no, the state does not underwrite that, so the bank cannot come back for a guarantee of the interest that would be incurred. So I just,
okay.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative.
And if you wanted to phone a friend from the banks, that's what you're.
No, and I think I understand what the question is here. So the principal is what is guaranteed. And the loan cannot accrue interest during the shutdown and during the 90-day grace period that follows that. The bank can charge interest during a 180-day period that follows the grace period. That would not be the interest is not part of the principal, and so therefore is not guaranteed by the bill.
Representative Swizinski.
Okay. All right. So just looking at the 2.5, how will deed just participate in, let's say you have, you know, 3% of your total loans that go out that do default. What does D currently do to collect on defaulted loans on it from individuals?
Representative Stevenson.
That is a great question. I'm not aware if Deed has a loan program like that in terms of collections and what they would do to do that. I would have to consult with Deed and get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, is someone from Deed here?
I don't see anybody from the room. It looks like Representative Mahoney maybe has some insight. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Swizinski. They don't make loans in this particular fashion. So they would have no capacity to do that. That would be the bank's issue to pick up that and collect on the defaulted loan. As I have read this bill, Deed would only pay out upon the default from a bank, and then the bank would have to do all of its own. That particular point, I guess we'll have to cover up Mr. Trump's mistakes one more time.
Representative Swizinski.
So, Madam Chair, it sounds like the taxpayers are responsible either way, whether or not they come up with the money to pay the federal employees, whether they come up with the money to guarantee the loan, whether they come up with the money to not or pay the banks back and not have a chance to actually recover those funds.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
You get what you vote for.
With the Speaker of the House, yes, we do.
To rein us back into the point of the bill and getting us to make sure that our federal employees are taken care of. We want, it's very clear that the banks are part of this process, and that's where the lending expertise comes from my understanding. Is that correct, Representative Stevenson?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes, I think that's correct.
Thank you. Additional questions there, Representative Swizinski?
So, I mean, just from a recourse standpoint, if I'm a federal employee who receives a loan that's guaranteed by the state and just don't pay my loan back, there's no recourse from a taxpayer. I mean, just you make a conscious decision. I mean, obviously this is a bad situation no one wants, but you know, from a precedent standpoint, I'm thinking about, issues up in maybe Representative Listigard's district where state actually has an opportunity to pass laws and create regulation that open up a mine or create jobs and maybe puts businesses out of the district or moves them out, where we actually have an opportunity to create jobs and do those things. We don't have a program just like this. We have training programs. We have other types of educational programs, but we don't have guarantee where regardless of the ability to pay back for things that we actually do here in the state. Just interesting. So,
thank you, Representative Swazinski. And there is a number of questions left among members, and we're butting up against the end of our committee time. So, would like to keep us moving forward. If additional questions need to be asked regarding the banking, I think that we should maybe ask Mr. Beeson to come down as well. Because my assumption is that there's opportunities for the banks have the infrastructure to do debt collection on those loans and to do default collections. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, just a couple of follow-up questions on things that my colleagues have talked about. And I think that Mr. Amundson's comments are very, very timely and prudent, because as a lender in the state of Minnesota, we pass a lot of laws that require lenders to treat people fairly and evenly, as is the federal law. Can you tell me if this particular bill applies only to state chartered institutions having to participate, or federal? Because I'll cut to the chase. The state really doesn't have the ability to tell federally chartered institutions what to do, because they're federally chartered, as it relates to the availability and the underwriting standards and stuff. And so has your bill taken into consideration that factor at all?
Representative Stevenson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, as you can see in the text of the bill, the program is available to state chartered and federally chartered banks. I did have the bill reviewed by the Department of Commerce and Deed, and they provided comments which were incorporated in the author's amendment.
Madam Chair, Driscoll.
As it relates to interest, I heard you say on both cases they can't charge interest, but then you also mentioned the fact that interest would be payable after the grace period. Can the lender accrue interest but not charge interest during the grace period?
Cannot. Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, they cannot.
Okay, that's a little bit of a clarification on your comments previously. Thank you for that. Madam Chair?
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill author, if the guarantee takes place where state taxpayer dollars do end up coming to shore up the financial institution on this, do you know if the financial institution is allowed to report to the credit reporting agencies that there was a default and that the state of Minnesota covered this loan? Or is that going to be something that an individual would not have to suffer any consequences for default as it relates to their credit standing?
Representative Stevens.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, and I will answer this, and then I see Mr. Beeson stepped up next to me, so if he thinks I'm wrong, he can correct me. But there's nothing in the bill language that would prevent a bank from reporting this to a credit bureau, and in fact, I think that the bank cannot collect on the guarantee until they have done their collection efforts in the ordinary course of their collection policy. I'm guessing for a number of banks that would include reporting to credit bureaus. But Mr. Beeson can correct me if I have misspoken.
Thank you, Representative
Mr. Beeson, welcome back.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my presumption would be that it would be reportable to the credit agencies. That is, it is a loan, and if there's a default on the loan, it is reportable. My comment about collecting, I think the financial institutions are the ones that should do the collecting. We have the apparatus in place. It's not unlike an SBA loan that we make, and I'll remind you that SBA loans are under collateralized. Sometimes they have no collateral, but the United States government guarantees those for us. They require us to cap the interest rate because of the guarantee, at a rate that's below what we would charge if we were lending unsecured money without a guarantee. So I hope that as we move forward, a lot of great questions, fair lending. We've talked to our compliance people preliminarily. We've got to get through the rest of the screens with the regulators, our preliminary read from our people is that there's something here that we can work with. We'll continue to stay focused on the details with the author.
Madam Chair?
I lost where that
Madam
came
Chair.
From. Representative O'Driscoll.
Don't need, Madam Chair. Another question that I have for the bill author is talking about the appropriation. It says that if there's a federal shutdown, and with Leader Pelosi's desire at one administration to be in favor of certain things and then in a different administration to be opposed to things, we're not exactly sure if we're going to come to a 2020 fiscal budget either. So the legislature won't be in session at that time. and there's $2.5 million that's been appropriated. Is that going to be enough money to be able to cover those workers who might suffer a setback and loss because of the inability for Congress and the administration to come to an agreement? And are we looking at a special session at that point to deal with that, or are we just picking certain federal workers who happen to be furloughed at a certain period of time that we're going to show them and defer preference to their needs over potential other presidents or other folks if the administration and Congress can't come to agreement? I guess to the bill author, to whoever might have the answer to that question for me. Maybe the chair does. I don't know.
Well, one thing that I would say is that this is what we're experiencing currently is unprecedented. This is the longest shutdown in U.S. government history. We had people, thousands and thousands of people in the state and around the country who missed two paychecks. I want us all to think about who we know in our life who can miss two paychecks. That's a small group of people. And so the fact that we are working and that the banking community has stepped up and our state administration has stepped up to say, what can we do to make sure that these folks aren't going into heavy credit card debt, aren't relying on payday lending, which is incredibly high interest and high risk, in order to meet their day-to-day obligations, from the roof that they put over their head to the food that they put on the table, to the places that they take their kids to daycare, to the gas that they put in their car, to get to the jobs that they were not getting paid to do for a month. So I would just note that in terms of thinking about the fact that this has never happened before. It's unfortunate that we have to make plans for such a devastating economic situation for people who are going to work every day to do things like keep us safe. But here we are, right? And I think that as we try to think about what could happen, a new bar has been set in terms of what could happen. And this particular bill, and I think the conversation that we're having, is really thinking about those what ifs. And I'll ask the author to comment. That's just my comments on your question. Representative Stevenson.
Well, I would say a few things. One is that I think that we are looking for a fiscal note analysis that should look at the full scope of possibility here. We are going to have a discussion about this in the Finance Committee, which would authorize the money. This, of course, being the policy committee that we're talking about this, and I think we'll have this same discussion in Chair Mahoney's committee. But that's a reason why we did limit it to shutdowns occurring in 2019. The other thing that I would point out is that the amount of money assumes that every affected employee takes out the full amount that they're eligible to, which we don't expect would happen. And so it's a conservative estimate, and we can have continued discussions about that in the Jobs Committee.
And Representative,
well, Madam Chair, I only raised the question because the bill author had indicated on certain social medias where the president had indicated that 21 days goes fast, different kinds of things. And if we are concerned about unprecedented, number one, what about 2.0 unprecedented, where Congress won't come to terms with the president on the issues? And it is a give and take. Everybody in this body knows that it's a give and take between the legislature and the executive branch. And so, I just asked that question. Are certain people going to be taken care of now? And then there's no way that we can take care of another group of people should that inevitability happen, that we end up with no fiscal budget at the end of September of 19 for fiscal 21. Or excuse me, fiscal 20 when it begins in October 1st of this year. It's a simple question, nothing complex, nothing nefarious about it. It's just a simple question for a topic that's been brought before this committee to consider today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, Representative Driscoll. I think it is it's a good question, and I think that some of the evidence in our ability to be nimble, which is state government is not always known for being nimble, but that creative thinkers are coming together in the private and public sector to think about 1.0 and do some planning about 2.0. So, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question. Why Deed rather than Commerce? Because Commerce is the banking department.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think that the thought process of why Deed has to do with where the bill originated from. It's modeled after legislation considered in other states where they made the decision to house it in Deed.
Representative Mahoney.
I have other...
Or in their equivalent to deed, I guess. That's what it says.
I have a few other questions that will come up in my committee, but I do have one quick comment. Government only gets to take its cut, as Representative Garofalo referred to, as the chair allows. And I know that this particular chair would not allow deed to take any particular piece of it. If banks can take the hit on the interest, I think state government, and I'll refrain from taking a shot at Mr. Trump. I think state government can take a small hit on administration.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Tabke, and then Representative Howard, and then I think we're going to go to a vote unless anybody has any last minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, what, again, is the maximum amount that can be loaned to an individual person?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Tabke, $15,000 is the max under this bill.
So no matter if there were
Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So no matter if there were another shutdown as within this bill, that is the max that could be given out at any time within here, correct?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Tabke, that is correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment in reference to Representative O'Driscoll's concern about the what if into the future. And I think that is a concern for us to wrestle with, but all the more reason why I'm grateful that Representative Stevenson is bringing this bill forward, for the opportunity to have it before this committee and further committees to wrestle with this and find a way that we can practically support, as the chair mentioned, workers that due to no fault of their own are missing paychecks and doing such vital work for the community, for the public. And so the what if is exactly the reason why it's important that this bill is before us, and look forward to it moving forward.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, is there anybody else in the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House to move House File 319 as amended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be referred to Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. You are on your way. With that, we have no business. I appreciate people staying late. We are adjourned.